This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG Radio this Friday, May 10th, 2024. I'm Philip Nice with our Philadelphia Trumpet writers. We have Richard Palmer and Mihailo Zekic.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
They're joining us, as always, from our offices in England. And here in Edmond, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller will be joining us shortly. They both record with me here in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. And if you're tuning in your radio at your home or your shop or your truck driving in the vicinity of North Edmond, Oklahoma, or if you're listening online, you might be wondering, what is Trumpet Hour and what's our purpose? How is this different? And is this worth listening to? Our function here every week on the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour on KPCG is to watch world events and to summarize them for you, but to watch them for something in particular. Many people are watching world events, in case you haven't noticed, on the radio waves, on all the podcasts. A lot of commentators, a lot of journalists and anchors and podcasters, they're trying to separate the true from the false and then the significant from the insignificant and run all this through their brain power and their experiences and their contacts and also their editors and their executives and their sponsors, and maybe compare it to parts of history that they think are relevant and then broadcast it to you. As you know, Trumpet Hour is not the only news show out there, and they spend all this time doing this instead of something else because they want to achieve whatever their goal is, to increase their popularity or their acceptance in certain circles or their influence on policy or their next contract bonus, or to prove themselves right, or whatever it is. It is different. It is different with Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller, and the other writers for the Philadelphia Trumpet and thetrumpet.com and Trumpet Hour Week in Review, because their purpose is to watch world events, to separate the true from the false, to separate the significant from the insignificant, and to judge it by something in particular, and that is Bible prophecy. And Bible prophecy, as explained by Herbert W. Armstrong, the late Herbert W. Armstrong, which some of you might have heard that name before, as well as Gerald Flurry, the Philadelphia Trumpet editor-in-chief. You're not relying, hopefully you're not relying on our brain power and our experiences and our funding and our sponsors, which we don't have any. You're relying on us to summarize world events compared to Bible prophecy as explained by Herbert W. Armstrong and Gerald Flurry in the Philadelphia Trumpet. And hopefully, for that matter, you're not relying on the brain power and the experiences and the connections and the money and the sponsors of Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity or Joe Scarborough or any other particular commentator or network or brand. I think we're seeing world events get so dire that you need something more than just a commentator's take on things. You need the truth. You need some kind of source that's more reliable, more transcendent, if you will, than the average podcaster out there or the average multimillionaire commentator, cable news commentator. So there are forecasts in the Bible that were recorded, often in detail, that have not occurred yet, or where the writer actually wrote that these events were for, quote, the time of the end, or, quote, the later days or the latter days. Sometimes the phrase in that day or similar phrases. In other words, Bible prophecy. And some people are naturally fascinated by Bible prophecy, by the fact that the Bible forecasts the future. Some are naturally disinclined to anything with that phrase in it. It feels like a weird phrase to them because many people have essayed to explain what this or that Bible prophecy means, and those explanations have failed. And so many people have believed that Bible prophecy has failed. But you have to account for the fact that it's everywhere in the Bible, that Jesus Christ himself was a prophet. So there's something about Bible prophecy that's very significant if you believe in the Bible, if you consider yourself a Christian, if you're just rational. The Bible is a very logical and a very rational book, and it's a feature of human history that has to be accounted for. But we could get into that in a different show. Based on Bible prophecy, we divide the globe and the news of the week into four different regions. The first of them is one of the most active many weeks, and certainly this week, one of the most violent from week to week. And that is the Middle East. It's been called a powder keg. Mihailo Zekić, one of his main jobs throughout the week is to watch the Middle East specifically and to summarize the news for you every Friday. Mihailo, what have been the top stories that you've been watching this week?
Well, U.S. President Joe Biden on Wednesday said that he would halt some armament shipments to Israel if they go ahead with their much-publicized, yet-to-actually-materialize Rafah crossing. Now, this is the first time that Biden has said this, and it is pretty precedent-setting as far as the U.S.-Israel relationship is concerned. And not only that, but it also is, if we were to believe media reports citing anonymous government officials, a broken promise. Because if you remember, we talked about it on this program back when Iran and Israel were doing those tit-for-tat strikes on each other. Apparently, the United States said that if Israel like de-escalated the situation and didn't do anything major, they would green-light the Rafah invasion. That has turned out to be a completely empty promise. And reportedly, according to an article recently uploaded by Axios, citing figures in the State Department, or at least people familiar with the inner workings of the State Department, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected to submit to Congress, perhaps as soon as today, a report about Israel's conduct in the Gaza war that would be critical of Israel, but stops short of concluding it has violated the terms of the U.S. sending it weapons. So Israel, even by the government's own standards, is not doing anything contrary to the agreements they've already signed up to. And yet Biden is still putting this pressure on Israel to stand down, to not finish the job. Also, the United Nations General Assembly is planning on voting to push forward to admit Palestine as a member state. They can't actually do that, but they could send another referral to the United Nations Security Council, which is the body which can make decisions. The UNGA is the general body where all UN members have a seat, have a vote. The state of Palestine, so-called, already has an observer membership status on this. So whatever happens with this, it won't really change too much on the ground. But it will show just how much the rest of the world is using this war as an excuse to try and harm Israel. In this case, according to the United Nations' own charter, a country can only be admitted to the United Nations if it is quote-unquote peace-loving. And when they were forming the resolution, according to, again, people with inside knowledge that media are citing, it hasn't actually happened yet, the vote, at least at the time of recording, they actually put that word, Palestine is a peace-loving state, in the original resolution. And then they had to drop it and scrub it for very obvious reasons that we've been talking about for about 6 months on this program. And even if you're talking about, okay, forget about Hamas, what about these other groups? We've talked about on this program before that Fatah also participated in the October 7 massacre. That's the faction that currently controls the Palestinian Authority. So you have to bend the rules and overlook a lot of stuff to consider the current Palestinian government any sense of peace loving. Yet, and I'm sure a lot of these governments know that, yet they're willing to look the other way and antagonize Israel in this forum that's been used to antagonize Israel so many times.
Just an update here on the situation in Rafah, of course, that last city, that last stronghold for Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip. Looking at Reuters here, and updated just an hour ago, it says Israeli tanks captured the main road dividing the eastern and western sections of Rafah. So we have Israeli tanks, Israeli troops on the ground in Rafah. It says they've effectively encircled the eastern part of the city because of some fighting around a mosque, and Hamas admitting that Israeli tanks are near a mosque in the eastern part of the city. The Israelis have now penetrated several kilometers from the eastern edge into the outskirts of the more built-up areas of Rafah. So we're probably having some heavy fighting ahead here on Friday as Israeli troops try to take the city of Rafah and eradicate Hamas's last power center in the Gaza Strip. What's the main thing that you've been looking at in the Middle East, Mihailo?
Well, the Houthi terror group, the faction that controls large chunks of Yemen and has been disrupting trade at the southern Red Sea, attacking merchant ships, they announced on May 3rd that they will begin targeting Israel-bound ships in the Mediterranean. Now, this technically happened last week, but the news only broke after we recorded this program, and it's pretty significant, so I thought I'd bring it up this week anyway. You think about where Yemen is and where the Houthis are targeting, mainly around the southern end of the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, That's been their main target. They have the capability, as we've talked about in this program before, to hit Israel itself. They have weaponry with that kind of a range. But now they're saying they're going to go even beyond that and even start attacking merchant ships trading with Israel on the other sea that Israel borders. You would think, at least as far as Yemen and that part of the world is concerned, like the furthest possible target that they could possibly hit. They so far haven't made good on their promise yet with radical groups like this. Just even the threat itself is enough to make people quiver in their boots a little bit. It's unlikely they would have made this threat if they didn't think they were able to carry it out. And they do have weapons that can carry it out, like the Shahed 136 drone, the so-called Iranian kamikaze drone that's been made famous by Russia using against Ukraine. So again, we'll see exactly what happens with this. But the big reason why this is just so important, we've talked about how much the Red Sea crisis has disrupted world trade, how it's caught the world's attention, how it's causing outside powers to get involved. If the Houthis start targeting ships in the Mediterranean, that would change the equation so much, especially for Europe. We talk on and on in this program about why we need to watch Europe and how Europe responds to this push, this prod from these Iranian proxies. In this case, the Mediterranean is in Europe's backyard. There's no indication that they could, say, reach European mainland or Cyprus or some of these other places. But this would basically mean an Iranian proxy, a very well-documented proxy of Iran, one of the most capable and dangerous, is disrupting shipping right in the southern flank of Europe itself. And you can bet Europe is not going to take that quite lightly. The reason we focus on this is a common prophecy we go to, Daniel 11, verse 40, which describes two power blocks, a king of the north and a king of the south, clashing. If you follow the prophecy on into the next chapter, it leads into a very serious crisis, what that passage calls a time of trouble, such as there never was a nation even to that same time. And since the 1990s, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerard Fleury, has identified the king of the north as a united European bloc led by Germany and the king of the south as radical Islam led by Iran. It's led by Iran, but it also includes Iran's proxies, like the Houthis. And he specifically noted that Iran is prophesied to push or provoke or unnecessarily go out of its way to be petty in its attacks to Germany, to give attacks that really hurt. And one thing that our editor-in-chief has told us to watch out for is Iran's manipulation of oceanic trade routes, of some of these choke points like the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and others, getting leverage over them and basically shutting out trade to Europe. We've seen this already happen with the southern end of the Red Sea there, but if the Houthis brought the fight over to the Mediterranean, and obviously they wouldn't be as effective sending drones and such to that end of the world rather than their home turf, but even if they were to disrupt a little, that would be a major provocation of Europe, an unnecessary one, a huge poke, a prod, a push. And as our editor-in-chief has also said, this push is going to bring a counter-push, shall we say, an overwhelming counter-attack. On our May-June print edition of this year, he wrote an article, "Is the Red Sea Crisis About to Fulfill Bible Prophecy?" And in that article, he speculated with everything that's going on in the Red Sea, with the Houthis, with Germany's response to it, this could very well turn into the push. We've seen Iran and its proxies poke at Europe and plenty of other people quite a bit, but nothing has morphed into the push yet in Daniel 11, verse 40. Mr. Fleury said, if something is going to turn into that, what's going on with the Houthis right now is a good candidate of that. Again, they haven't actually started targeting ships in the Mediterranean yet. We'll see if they actually carry out that threat. But the fact that they're even willing to openly put out that challenge is a pretty big push in and of itself. And it's something that Europe certainly will be taking note of.
It's also a story that's not going to go away. Like, this just has the potential to escalate and escalate. Another story I saw this week is that Iran is building factories deep in the mountains of Yemen to create more drones, more missiles, according to a Kuwait-based newspaper, which, you know, they really want to keep up the pressure. And if Europe doesn't respond this week, they're building factories to keep going and keep going, and, you know, whatever it does take to gain a response. I mean, there's a long-term commitment in building factories. So I think it's just been fascinating. You know, one of the things that I point out to my students in the international relations class that I teach is, just one of the most exciting things you can do in the news is watch Bible prophecy happen in real time. that you can read these words from your Bible that are written thousands of years ago, and you can just see it happening every day. And that's what this week and these last few months have been with this forecast. Not just like the Bible, it's so detailed. It's not just that you're going to have a confrontation between Iran and Europe, but that sea gates and the Red Sea and the Mediterranean are going to form a core part of that. You know, if you're not familiar with this prophecy, I'd really encourage you to read up on it now so that you have the opportunity to watch your Bible come alive almost every day, every week, as we get more and more of these developments.
That's Richard Palmer there in studio with Mihailo Zekic. Mr. Palmer, you watch Europe, which interacts with the Middle East. You teach classes, which I think next week we'll kind of talk a little bit about some of the classes. It's the end of the semester, and so it's just an exciting time on campus there where you are as well as here. But as I say, you watch the Europe region, which interacts with the Middle East. Can't help but interacting with the Middle East and North Africa. It also interacts with Asia. Give us just a quick rundown of the top stories that you've been watching from the Europe region.
A German politician cited government statistics about rape in Germany and found herself with a 6,000 euro fine. These statistics showed that Afghans are dramatically overrepresented within rape statistics. She wrote, I guess what you could call a fairly inflammatory piece on social media, talking about the prevalence of gang rape among migrant communities, but nothing in there was wrong. And it's all based on official statistics, and she's found herself with a 6,000 euro fine. This is, I think, is something very dangerous within Germany. She's from the Alternative for Deutschland party, this party that we have been very critical of on this show, that we have talked about, has some genuine neo-Nazis within it. But if you give people fines for speaking the truth, you're going to force people to go towards the far right because they're the only ones that are going to speak out against this kind of thing. So absolutely, I think this is something that's going to blow up in the German government's face, and you're going to see this leading to real discontent within Germany. And you know, another story from this week quite strongly relates to that, where we're seeing more and more political violence within Germany. You had far-right thugs attack a left-wing politician in Dresden in Germany over the weekend. There was somebody who was attacked in around the same area for putting up posters for the Green Party. Then you had later on some supporters of the Alternative for Deutschland party were themselves attacked. This is very much history repeating itself. Like, political violence was a huge deal in the 1930s, where you had communists and national socialists fighting in the streets, intimidating rival politicians. This is small beer compared to some of what you had in the 20s and 30s. But the fact that you're getting it returning is a dangerous symptom, again, of the dissatisfaction, the strength of feeling, the rise of radical elements within Germany. People can see that Germany is readying for a massive change in its politics. And the main story today is another item that is proving a catalyst for massive changes within Europe.
So more evidence that Europe, that Europeans are getting fed up. And as you said, these are small, especially compared to their historical precedent, but they add on to similar events from weeks past. And these are not so isolated. There's more to report from week to week that the Europeans are getting fed up and are turning to, if I can put it this way, stronger parties that are just enough is enough. And as you've written well, we're about to see some drastic changes in Europe. You mentioned your main topic you provided in our outline. It has to do with European foreign policy and its interactions with the Asia region.
That's right. I kind of muscled into Mihailo's region earlier, and right. Now I'm invading Asia. I guess on form, very on form for Central European powers today. But that is that, yeah, Russia has announced they're going to practice using tactical nuclear weapons. So this is very concerning to a lot of people in Europe. Russia has conducted strategic nuclear weapons drills in the past. So there's a big difference between these different types of nuclear weapons. Strategic nuclear weapons are designed to win you the war. You go in there and it wipes out an entire city. Tactical nuclear weapons are designed to win you the battle. They are battlefield nuclear weapons is how they're sometimes labeled. They are much smaller. And because of that, they're considered much scarier. It's a little counterintuitive.
Right.
But if Russia attacks NATO or the United States with a strategic nuclear weapon, it's very clear cut. You know, you bomb New York and Moscow is going. And there's very little room for doubt there. So people generally say, well, Russia, they would never do it because they know that then they'll lose Moscow or St. Petersburg. They're going to get wiped off the map. It's going to mean the end of the world. Tactical nuclear weapons, because they're smaller, the theory is they'd be more likely to use it. You know, if Russia goes in there and uses a tactical nuclear weapon on the battlefield in Ukraine, it could create a lot of casualties, etc., while not necessarily reaching the threshold of a response, or at least a nuclear response. You've got a much more difficult decision. Do you start nuclear World War III and end the human race over this thing that didn't quite destroy a city? So the traditional kind of nuclear theory looks at these as being more dangerous. So the fact that Russia is practicing these has really gotten Europe's attention. And it's in response to some statements. British Foreign Minister David Cameron, he made a speech where he talked about how he was fine with British-made long-range missiles being used to strike deeper within Russia. French President Emmanuel Macron has said that he's open to the possibility of French soldiers being deployed in Ukraine. So Russia said it would hold these tactical nuclear drills in response to, quote, provocative statements and threats of certain Western officials regarding the Russian Federation. At the same time, he's also stepped up pressure against the United States, where there was, it looks like, some idiot American soldier decided to go on holiday to Russia and got himself arrested. So now they've got an American soldier hostage. But all of this is very much getting the attention of the West and, in particular, Europe. And this story, just like those things we kind of talked about at the top of the Europe section, is something that's producing massive changes in Europe. I was producing the World Watch for the Trumpet Print this week, where we kind of summarized the important trends of the month to go in the Trumpet Print magazine. And basically, I find myself focusing on just one story where there have just been so many smaller pieces of news regarding Europe's military turnaround, different meetings, different calls, French President Emmanuel Macron offering to share Europe's nuclear deterrent for the first time, Germany having a national holiday for its military industry get-togethers where they're figuring out how can we produce more in defense. Like, this is another prophetic story where every day or every week you are having things moving this forwards, and Europe's attitude towards its military is very steadily changing. And it's all being driven by fear of Russia. This is something Herbert W. Armstrong talked about decades ago. He wrote, this is in November 1982, where he said this actually, one of the great things that is urging Europe on, perhaps the greatest thing that will cause them to hurry and get together on this, is their fear of what is going on in the Kremlin and the Soviet Union. And he said, and Andropov is frightening them and is going to rush them. They're losing confidence in the United States as having a military umbrella over them to protect them, and they want their own military force to protect themselves. That is the way they feel over there. That is a chief incentive to unite them, and that is taking place. And sure, maybe that didn't happen to the extent that Mr. Armstrong thought it would under Yuri Andropov, but it is happening now precisely the way that he described. And it's happening precisely the way that he described it because that forecast was based on Bible prophecy. And he didn't know exactly when that prophecy would be fulfilled, but he knew all of those details in the Bible about how it would be fulfilled. That's what we're seeing in Europe now, as Europe steadily transforms its attitude towards military, its military capabilities, and is really starting to take these steps that we forecast for years now.
Germany and Europe's steady transformation continues. You've been watching for this for years. The Trumpet has been watching for this for decades. As you mentioned, Herbert W. Armstrong in The Plain Truth and on the World Tomorrow Radio was watching this for decades, all because the Bible forecasted it centuries, millennia ago. Of course, the word Germany is not in the Bible. You need to know why Mr. Armstrong applied Bible prophecies about a nation called Assyria to modern Germany. And you need to follow up. You need to look it up. Look at Germany is Transforming Before Your Eyes at thetrumpet.com. That's Germany is Transforming Before Your Eyes there at thetrumpet.com/library. You're listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review here on KPCG 101.3. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Hello and welcome back to Trumpet Hour Week in Review here on KPCG. We've covered the Middle East region with Mihailo Zekic. We've covered the Europe region with Richard Palmer. Now we'll cover the Asia region with Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to mention just a little bit more about this U.S. soldier that Russia arrested this week. This soldier was a staff sergeant stationed in South Korea, and he traveled to Vladivostok, Russia, to visit a Russian girlfriend there, even though he is married. Now, we know from social media that this soldier bought into a lot of Russian propaganda. He would post clips of himself saying basically that Russia is the good guy in its wars and America is the bad guy. So I'm not sure why he chose the U.S. military as his career, but in either case, he apparently thought that he would be safe visiting his Russian girlfriend in the country that he seems to love most. But the Russian government says that while the soldier was in Vladivostok, that he stole something. And I guess that is possible. This man, you know, obviously is not the most clear-eyed individual. But in recent years, we have seen the Russian government fabricate reasons to arrest various Americans, just because it gives Russia leverage to get some of its own people out of U.S. prisons, and sometimes just as a scare tactic of sorts. So this is most likely a situation where as soon as this soldier's passport was swiped, the plan went into action for Russia to arrest him. And I do pity this man because his life is ruined, his marriage is ruined, and who knows how long he'll be in Russia's brutal penal system. But I think that it won't be long before he starts to realize that Russia is not the virtuous nation that he thought it was. And I imagine he's already missing the USA. Another quick story here about Chinese leader Xi Jinping visiting Europe. He completed a tour of various European capitals on Wednesday. He was in Paris, first of all, meeting with the French president and the EU commission chief, basically just trying to increase trade between Asia and Europe. From there, Chairman Xi went to Serbia. Serbia, of course, is a close ally to Russia. So by extension, that makes it a partner to China as well. And China and Serbia do seem to have been brought closer together by this visit. And then finally, Xi Jinping went to Hungary to meet with Viktor Orban and to boost China-Hungary ties. This was probably the most notable development of this trip, because China and Hungary boosted their bilateral relations to what they called an all-weather comprehensive strategic partnership. So it's clear that Xi Jinping really focused during this trip on European nations that share in his goal of ending the era of U.S. dominance. And at the trumpet, we expect this kind of Asia-Europe cooperation to increase and for that to be to the detriment of the United States.
So a Chinese leader, a strong man, rising in strength, increasing in power, and asserting that power internationally. What would be the main story that you think is worth dwelling on out of Asia?
It is that China's third aircraft carrier, called the Fujian, completed its maiden sea trials on Wednesday. And this is important because this aircraft carrier is far more advanced than China's first two, and it represents a major milestone in the advancement of China's, just their general naval capabilities. So China's first aircraft carrier was fairly primitive. It was rebuilt from an old Soviet carrier that China had bought from Ukraine back in the 90s. And that one used kind of like a ski lift ramp to get planes up in the air. So that's not optimal, especially with larger warplanes. That first carrier was launched in 2012, and then China's second aircraft carrier was launched in 2017. And that one, it was a step up from the first one, but it was still based on that old Soviet design and still used the old ski jump method. But this third one is an entirely new class. Instead of using ramps the way the first and second one did, this third one uses a far more advanced electromagnetic catapult system to get planes in the air. So this means larger, heavier planes can get airborne. It also means the planes use a lot less fuel during takeoff. That means they can, you know, fly longer missions. And this technique is considerably less jarring for the aircraft, which means aircraft launched this way have a lot more longevity. They can fly more missions. So this technology is what most of the U.S.'s aircraft carriers use. So that really shows you just how advanced this new Chinese aircraft carrier is. They've skipped some big steps between the first two carriers and this later one. And it's not just the catapult system that makes the Fujian a major milestone.
Besides the electromagnetic catapults, the Fujian is novel because it's 50% larger than the previous Chinese carrier, the Shandong. Indeed, Fujian, at its 80,000 tons of displacement, is roughly comparable to the U.S. Forrestal class. That was the first of the U.S. Navy's supercarriers.
That was Binkov's Battlegrounds there, just explaining that the size of the Fujian is also remarkable. With 80,000 tons of displacement, it is in the same basic category as the U.S. Navy's first supercarriers. And with its massive deck, it's expected to be able to operate an air group of more than 50 aircraft. So the Fujian is a major advance for the Chinese Navy.
I remember you covering on this show the expansion of Chinese naval power as a in years to come type of thing. They're building carrier. You know, we're getting this news that they're building carriers or they're refitting a Russian carrier. Now it's reality. Those things have not been slowed. They haven't been prevented. China's massive economy and its increasingly aggressive foreign policy has blue water vessels, ocean-going vessels in the water. And presumably these carriers are accompanied by destroyers and submarines, strike groups, and watch out for in years to come type of news is now the this just happened news in China. How significant are these particular aspects of the Chinese Navy to the Navy and to China?
Well, over the last few years, we've seen China really take over the South China Sea, building artificial islands there, militarizing those islands. It's also, of course, as you just said, built up its naval might by an astounding degree at the same time. And with that expanded presence in the South China Sea, and with its increased number of warships, China has been asserting its will far beyond its coasts. It's taken over the Scarborough Shoal there in the Philippines. It's kicked Vietnam and Indonesia out of their own waters in places where China wants to be the only one drilling for oil. So China has not just been amassing all this power, but it is putting that power to use. And with these aircraft carriers, especially this latest, more advanced one, we can expect that same kind of Chinese behavior to be happening farther and farther away from Beijing. We can expect China to start deploying carrier groups eventually to anywhere in the world and to be able to bully other nations and assert China's will and basically just further China's goal of becoming a global superpower. You know, aircraft carriers were a major part of America's dominance of the world over the last seven decades or so. And China has learned from that and is utterly dead set on becoming the new dominant power. And this is very important because Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote an article in our August 2020 edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet. It's called Where the China-America Clash is Leading. And he focuses in that article mostly on what we've been discussing here, China's increasing naval power and its takeover of the South China Sea with that power. And Mr. Fleury looks at it all through the lens of Bible prophecy. He especially focuses on a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 about the U.S. losing control of the shipping lanes and maritime choke points that it once had control over. And he talks about America losing them mainly to China. He really emphasizes China here. So with China's Navy becoming so powerful and having now added yet another aircraft carrier, far more advanced than its first two, we can really see this taking shape because it was the U.S. that had kept the South China Sea region open to world trade pretty much since the end of World War II. But now China is becoming more and more in control of this area. And Mr. Fleury's article shows that this shifting power balance is fulfilling that prophecy from Deuteronomy 28. So it's a very important article to read as we see China's naval power continue to increase.
And as you say, they are putting that power to use. We're seeing gains. We're seeing the strategic lay of the land or water change based on these developments, these accomplishments. They are turning the South China Sea into effectively a Chinese Gulf. And that's not just a tactical win or a diplomatic win, but that's a strategic level win. As you say, it's a strategic objective. If you're the Chinese Communist Party, you have strategic objectives that you are building toward. in order to become, as you say, a global superpower. So with three carriers in the water, this third one, I think fair to say it's a super carrier, you know, generally speaking, a super carrier class vessel. So now with the Chinese super carrier in the water, you're going to see more and more strategic objectives being accomplished by the Chinese Communist Party. You can learn more about this, as Jeremiah says, in Where is the China-America Clash Leading at thetrumpet.com. That's Where is the China-America Clash Leading. Our fourth region is the Anglo-America region. Andrew Miller has joined us. Give us an update, Andrew, on Anglo-America.
Yeah, a political report out this week revealed that the anti-Israel protests that are still rocking universities across America are actually being funded by many of the same organizations funding Biden's reelection campaign. The Federal Reserve Chairman of Minnesota revealed that the unprecedented border crisis is actually increasing the housing shortage in America, and then exacerbating the already historic housing affordability crisis, to where the median house price is seven times the median income and getting worse. And in legal news, the court case charging Donald Trump with willfully retaining classified documents after leaving the White House has been postponed indefinitely by United States District Judge Cannon, after they found out that there may not be as enough evidence for the prosecution to make a case as they thought.
That's Andrew Miller's Anglo-America rundown for you. Maximum news, minimum sentences. Let's spend a few more sentences, though, Andrew, on the main topic. I am really interested in this main topic, and hopefully we'll get comments on it from the rest of our panel. But go ahead and introduce to us what you thought was the main thing for Trumpet Hour listeners to be thinking about this week.
Yeah, well, the main thing I'm introducing this week is a little different. It's shifting gears from the just pure geopolitical angle of American news, but men are disappearing across American society, both literally and figuratively. If you look at your average university, there's seven male dropouts for every woman who drops out. If you look at the churches in America, men are leaving church in droves. It's actually now up to about 60% of churchgoers are women. And this last one's one of the most shocking, is like the current unemployment rate for men entering their prime working years is actually as bad as it was during the Great Depression. Now, it's kind of masked. It doesn't feel like depression-level employment because there's so many women in the workforce now that wouldn't have been there back then. Whether you're looking at universities, whether you're looking at churches, whether you're looking at the workplace, men have just kind of gone AWOL across American society, which makes this next point all the more symbolic, is that they finally announced this year, they've kind of been expecting it for a couple years, that they're actually deleting, literally deleting, the word boy from the Boy Scouts. So the Boy Scouts of America has been around for 114 years, and it's now just going to be called Scouting America, which is a decision that makes some sense because back in 2013, they allowed openly homosexual boys to join the Scouts. 2 years later, they allowed homosexual troop leaders. 2 or 3 years later, they allowed girls to join the Boy Scouts. And then about a year after that, transgenders. And so it's no longer an institution for boys anyway. So it doesn't make sense to call it the Boy Scouts if it's not for boys. But the fact that they've made those changes to the point where they're actually deleting the name is really significant, because you know a little bit about the history of that institution. It wasn't just a camping club. It was founded in 1910 under a lot of encouragement and guidance from President Theodore Roosevelt. At a time when a lot of Americans, they were leaving the farm, they were leaving the frontier, they're going to the cities, there was actually society-wide concern about like the decline in masculine skills even back in 1910. And so this organization was founded to promote patriotism, to promote male leadership and male skills, including not just camping, but like electrical work and plumbing. Like you've got a merit badge for everything. You've got your electrical merit badge. You've got your plumbing merit badge. You've got your other merit badges. And then Theodore Roosevelt, he wrote a couple essays really supporting this. as something really necessary for American masculinity, or actually Roosevelt rarely used fancy Latin words. He preferred the term manliness. That's the one he used in all his editorials. But he said, this was an organization to promote manliness amongst American men. That was its mission statement, basically. I think Roosevelt definitely phrased it in that blunt of terms. A couple of the other ones I said, like, well, patriotism and individualism and all these skills. And so the fact that you're deleting the word boy from Boy Scout it's not just a general statement that girls should be able to go camping too. It's actually taking an organization designed to develop masculinity in American men and making it so the entire organization is no longer about masculinity anymore.
Right. As a proud former member of the Scouts, I have to debunk some of the fake news you've heard from Andrew there, but still agree with his overall conclusion. Scouting began in 1907 and was set up by Robert Baden Powell, and America and Theodore Roosevelt copied it 3 years later. Let's get the record straight. It was a lieutenant general in the British Army that kicked this global movement off. To my knowledge, the Scouts, I've just always known it as the Scouts here in the UK. It's never had boy in the name. So, like, yeah, you could be like, okay, well, it's just like it's always been Scouts in Britain. But you look at the agenda behind getting rid of boy. You know, it's not essential to say Boy Scouts to have a great scouting organization. The agenda behind that is something that is all about completely watering down and changing what Scouts is there for.
It's so important, I think, to stop and take stock. Masculinity in America. As you say, this is not a geopolitical event that happened on Wednesday. You know, this is not like the news of the week or the news of the moment. They're killing the Boy Scouts of America. There's your news peg, your current event. And someday they're going to blot out that other offensive word in the name America. But you are bringing us this segment that I think is so important, that masculinity is being killed, and it's being killed in America, in Britain, in certain nations, other nations, not so much of an attack on masculinity, but certainly a strong attack. And I just wanted to get some thoughts from the rest of the panel. Why is it that masculinity is under attack?
Yeah, I think this is one of those topics that... like I said, it's not a geopolitical event that happened on Wednesday, but it is like one of the root cause behind all the important bad geopolitical events that happened on Wednesday. The scripture I brought with me this week is in Isaiah 3 verses 1 through 3 that talks about the curses God sends on a nation that turns away from his law. And he talks about taking away like the man of war and the judge and the prudent and the eloquent and the cunning artificer and making it so that women and children rule over you. And so it's really what this passage is talking about is just a fundamental leadership vacuum in America and Britain and the other nations of Israel, specifically talking about like children being their princes and women ruling over them, a male leadership vacuum that causes all the other problems. You've got foreign policy crises because there's no masculine generals. And you've got legal lawfare persecuting citizens because there's no like competent masculine judges. Yeah, our cutting artificer, that actually brings to mind both the lack in America and the STEM fields, the science fields. And then also, like I said, with scouting, just because they put so much emphasis on a merit badge for every skill you learn. Like I said, they're not teaching those masculine skills anymore. The ripple effects like this cause all the other bad news events that I normally talk about on Anglo-America on this program.
Well, I completely agree with what Andrew said. I think it's just interesting. It's both a cause and an effect. And I can it absolutely is a massive cause of so much of the decline of Britain and America. And it's what goes on in the family then is affecting national news. I wanted to come at it also from this kind of effect angle where I think masculinity is being deliberately attacked and discouraged by kind of those on high. Because if you want to fundamentally transform the United States and you want to create this kind of new, perhaps utopianist, communist kind of society, who are your biggest opponents? Well, in general, it's men. It's people that are going to stand up, defend America, believe in America or believe in Britain, whichever country it's happening in, and oppose you. And so they're going out of their way to attack that. And you see that, I think, in the way that, you know, there was the story on the New York subway. This was a few months ago. You had some crazed, drug-addicted person attacking or doing things to people. Someone stood up and confronted him, and the person doing the confronting was arrested. And this is happening again and again. Andrew mentioned the student protests. You saw this. I saw a story today out of University of California, Los Angeles, where the LA Times was talking about how the UCLA was gearing up for their biggest case in history. And it was all around campus protests, but it was not about the people that were trying to block off Jews from going to attend classes and intimidate people and set up barricades on public property. No, it was about the men that stood up to shut that down, that said, hey, you want to block Jews from going to class? We're going to move the barriers aside so that they can come in. You know, they said, well, we want to give those people the January 6th treatment. We want to attack that. Now, look, I'm not up here saying we need to take the law into your own hands, you know, any of those things. Clearly, there's a whole kind of separate debate there. My point is just that there is a deliberate attempt from the radical left to attack masculinity and manhood, and it's happening through the education system. And then when you do have examples of real masculinity cut through, and maybe at times it's a bit misguided or whatever, they come on down on that like a ton of bricks because they're trying to stamp it out.
It is irrational, this attack on masculinity. It does not make sense. It is not constructive to the human race. It is not constructive to the country. It is anti-human to fundamentally transform, to progressively, to intentionally dismantle masculinity. You're talking about half of the population or a little less that has a certain role to fulfill in the family, in the society, in the nation. And in the 1990s, when Mr. Fleury was writing Conspiracy Against Fatherhood and so forth, people said, oh, well, you know, maybe, maybe not. At this point, you cannot deny that something extremely powerful and extremely intentional is definitely specifically targeting masculinity. And even among the people out there who are promoting masculinity, they're using that word in many cases, as you said, to promote things that are not real masculinity, what it really is, what the creator of human beings, the creator of the two sexes, the creator of masculinity and femininity created. Even among the pro-masculinity crowd, there's a intelligence op, there's a misinformation op to obscure what real masculinity is. If you want to know what the purpose of half the population is, why the one half of the population, one half of the human creation is different than the other half, then you would go back to the creator and you would know then if it's masculine to use your superior physical strength to do X, Y, or Z, whether it's masculine to keep the rule of law, to not take the law into your own hands, as you say. Those things are in the manual for masculinity, the Holy Bible. And this society is suffering the effects of what at this point is an undeniable, coordinated, strategic attack on masculinity. And that's something that I think, Andrew Miller, it's your right to dwell on here in the Week in Review. That is all the time we have for the Week in Review here on KPCG 101.3 here in Edmond. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate you emailing us your thoughts on the program. Didn't have time to get to the comment I wanted to read today, but you can send us your comments at letters@thetrumpet.com. Hopefully we'll be able to discuss some of these things next week. Now, we want to thank our panel, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic, and also Isaac Lorenz and Parker Campbell, without whom this whole show would not happen. So we appreciate you guys and your skills and your time. But most of all, we thank you, whether you're driving in North Edmond, whether you're listening on a podcast, wherever you might be, for listening to The Week in Review. And we look forward to being back with you next time on Trumpet Hour.